I'm Susan LeBay for Women's Focus, and today I'm talking to David Lisak in his home in Placidas. Welcome to Women's Focus.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, recently there's been a lot of reaction to a trial that happened that took place in California, and a lot of controversy, or at least reaction to what the judge, what people perceive as being too lenient, and sort of going into the boys will be boys kind of attitude. And since we have someone who's done a lot of research on this area, I thought it would be interesting to get your take on it and hear a little bit about what your research shows. So let's just talk a little bit about what you found in your research.
Well, a couple of things that I think really stand out. The research that I did is primarily focused on college rapists. So very much like the Stanford case. And what we've found over the years, many different studies, is that many of the behaviors, characteristics, personality characteristics that have been documented in incarcerated rapists, rapists who are out there in the community, more likely stranger rapists, many of those same characteristics you find in these college men who are committing rapes. The other thing that we've found, and not only us, but there have been a number of studies that have documented the same thing, is a propensity for serial offending. So in colleges in particular, there has been almost an assumption that when there's a sexual assault committed by a college student, that it's a one-time deal, and everybody looks at alcohol immediately. So it's as though if that student had not been drunk, if there had been clear communication, and it wouldn't have happened. So almost like an accident, a confluence of circumstances and factors and an accident that, you know, maybe we could prevent, you know. And the research actually really conflicts, actually contradicts that assumption on a number of different levels. One is we have now a number of studies that show that a majority and possibly a strong majority of college rapists are repeat offenders. So right away, the fact that they're doing this repeatedly suggests that this is not an accident. Mm-hmm. We have research that shows that alcohol isn't the causative factor. It is individuals who have a propensity to do this, who have control, anger, antisocial issues, who use alcohol essentially as a weapon to render their victims incapacitated, exactly as we see in the Stanford case. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that we have some pretty good research now, it's very interesting research that's been coming out, is researchers have been looking at this issue of communication and cues. You know, is it the case that somehow, you know, since most of these assaults are male on female, is it the case that these males are somehow unable to understand the verbal and nonverbal cues that they that they receive from people in these encounters, in these sexual encounters? And actually, the research is clearly showing that men understand these cues, women understand these cues. Actually, there's research showing that they're the same kinds of cues that people use in all kinds of other circumstances, mm-hmm. where there's never this kind of, you know, assumption that these are so murky and so hard to understand that you know, this would be the cause of rape. So there are many, many different strands of research that are clearly showing that just as we see in the general community, just as we see in the military, where there's also been a lot of research, mm-hmm. that the real core of the problem of sexual violence is that we have a number of individuals who have, for a variety of reasons, this propensity to commit these kinds of crimes. And of course, it all happens in the context of a culture that really it supports the violence, it supports the view of other people, especially women, as objects, and it supports a kind of a narcissism and entitlement, all of which contribute to these individuals believing that this is their right and frankly that they can get away with it.
Okay. You've said a lot of things that sort of bring up questions in my mind, especially the narcissism and entitlement. I think that would go along with the athletes sort of believing that it's their right kind of.
Yeah. And yes, and it's clearly, you know, the case that when you have on a college campus an athletic program, and it, you know, the sport varies from campus to campus, that becomes, you know, high profile in some cases, like basketball and football, or in some areas hockey becomes, you know, actually a financial sort of pillar of the university. Mm-hmm. There's a tremendous amount of stature that goes with that, and that obviously contributes, or can contribute, to this sense of entitlement and the sense that pretty much anything they do, they can get away with. Now, I think it's important to note that there are many athletic programs in many universities across the country where this is not or rarely a problem, and it's because you have coaches and coaching staffs that realize that part of their duty and part of the responsibility is to inculcate in their athletes a sense of responsibility and a sense that, yeah, you walk around this campus and people look up to you and you feel great about that. Well, that's nice, but with that comes a responsibility, and your behavior has to match that responsibility. So you can do that. You know, you can take some of these potentially toxic aspects of athletic programs and still, you know, kind of a little jujitsu, turn it into something educational, something that, you know, sort of shapes a sense of citizenship and responsibility in these individuals. But if that doesn't happen, if you have coaching staffs, you know, that are really just completely focused on winning and are loath to lose the services of an athlete, and so they won't, you know, they try to cover up these assaults and cover up other kinds of misconduct, you know, then you've got a really toxic problem. And that's why we see these cases coming up over and over again involving athletes.
Okay. Tell me, how do you do the research? Is it from asking questions, or is it looking at reported incidents? Does the research go into non-reported incidents?
Yes, the research that's come out of universities now going back to the 1980s has been founded on really a common methodology, which is we've known for a long time that if you want to know in a fairly accurate way how many people have either experienced sexual victimization or committed it or perpetrated it, you can't ask questions directly. You can't ask somebody, have you ever been raped? Mm-hmm. And you can't ask somebody, of course, have you ever raped anybody? Mm-hmm. One of the problems is it's not just that it's too direct. It's that most people really don't understand what rape is. Yeah. You know, most people have this idea still that a rape is when some guy in a ski mask wielding a knife drags somebody into the bushes. Mm-hmm. So what we've done now for decades is, when it comes to assessing perpetration, is we ask very, very behaviorally explicit questions that, in very graphic language, in very concrete language, describe what any prosecutor, any detective in the country would immediately recognize as rape. But we never use the word rape, and we never use the word assault or abuse. We just describe it as essentially a sexual encounter. But it is described in enough detail that there's no mistaking, that there's no consent, that either force was used, and we define force, or threats of force, and we define that, or with an incapacitated individual, and that is described vividly. So there's really no mistaking it if you understand what rape is. But what we've found for 30-some years is that the misconception about rape is so widespread that you can ask these questions, and people who have committed these acts will tell you, because they don't think that they're disclosing anything criminal or anything wrong. Okay. It's just kind of the way things, everybody does this kind of thing.
Okay. That's what just comes to mind, is why in heaven's name do they answer these questions?
Well, not only do they answer them, but in a number of the studies that I've done, we followed up these questionnaire sort of data collections with interviews. So we would interview all of the men who acknowledged committing acts that meet the legal definition of rape. We'd also interview control subjects. And during those interviews, we would have a tape recorder going, sitting on a coffee table right in front of them, and we just go through this, and we would get full narratives about what exactly happened. What, you know, and these would be long, sometimes 10, 20 minutes of describing a particular incident where they committed a rape. And they're doing this with a tape recorder going in front of them. So it has been a powerful tool. I mean, on the one hand, the misconception about rape, the idea that, the fact that so many people still think rape involves, again, that guy in a ski mask and a stranger with a weapon is a real problem in many, many ways, and certainly a problem for prosecutors who have to try to prosecute these cases. It has been to our advantage in being able to do this kind of research. And I think we may be coming to the end of this period, because there's been so much publicity now, especially in the last several years on college campuses, that it's hard for me to believe that it's going to be possible to use what comes down to deception, that more of our subjects are going to realize what we're asking here and essentially either not answer at all or say no.
Yeah.
Just say no. And there's actually a study that came out recently that found substantially lower percentages of perpetration being disclosed. And my guess is that we're seeing the beginning of that. The end of this type of research.
Okay. Do you think this is something that happens just when they're in college? Or do you think it's something that they didn't do before college, but that they continue doing after college?
Well, there's no question that some of these repeat offenders essentially are classic sex offenders. And we don't have really good longitudinal data, pre and then beyond college. But we do have some glimpses. So there are, I think I could think of two or three studies that have documented that students who commit sexual assaults when they get to college are more likely to have been students who committed sexual assaults already in high school. What we don't have are longitudinal data that go forward from college. But certainly my concern, and anybody who studies sex offenders would have the concern, that when you have somebody who has consolidated a pattern of behavior like this, where they have begun committing sexual assaults in high school, they have committed sexual assaults in college, you would have to be a blind optimist to think that they're somehow going to leave college and leave that behavior behind. That's not what we know about sex offenders.
Yeah. Sort of think of Mike Tyson or someone like that. Yeah. What has been missing in the discussion to me, and I keep wondering why no one talks about it, is the idea that rape is not a sexual act. It's really about power and rage, I guess, and that doesn't seem to come up at all.
Well, for many, many years, this was, I think back in the 70s and into the 80s, it was one of the first battles to get people to stop thinking about rape as somehow, as primarily a sexual or sexually motivated act. So you had people literally saying, well, if we'd make prostitution legal, we wouldn't have rapists, right? We wouldn't have rape because you wouldn't have to. You could just go buy it. And you still hear versions of that, or the argument around, pornography or something. And yet we've had now decades of research documenting that if you had to pinpoint one motivation that's probably at the top of the list, I think I would put that as power, as control and power. And anger has certainly also been very well documented as one of the primary motivations. And usually, of course, these are completely interlaced. And they're also interlaced with some of the other things that we've already talked about, with narcissism, with entitlement, with a sense that, I'm owed this, or I deserve this, or it doesn't matter, she's unconscious anyway.
Yeah.
Those kinds of, sort of just completely, sort of the complete absence of empathy and regard for another person as a human being. So all of those motivations, sort of feed into each other. And of course, then there's a really toxic cultural mix. These men aren't individually all inventing, this idea or this, they grow up consuming from their culture, from movies, from the internet, from their peers, from, yet you can treat other people this way, that, if that other person, again, just staying within the sort of the most common framework for this, which is, you know, sort of a heterosexual male on a heterosexual female, you know, this idea that you can look at and treat a woman as basically a non-human object, you know, there for your whatever gratification of whatever your needs are. And what you see, and I think the Stanford case, since it's on many people's minds now, if you just sit for a moment and think about what you've read, mainly from the description of those two Swedish graduate students who witnessed it, of that rapist, you know, at next to a dumpster,
I know.
You know, and what he was doing to her. I don't want to, you know, I don't even want to, you know, sort of describe again. I mean, people, if they can go read it again if they want. But just think about that, you know, that image, that what was going on, and think, does that really sound like somebody who is gratifying a sexual urge?
No.
You know, I think you can just rely on that sense, on your own common sense, you know, that there's something way more, you know, sort of deeper, having to do with acting out all kinds of really distorted sort of ideas and images about who he is and what he is entitled to, and who this other human being is.
Yeah, that's what just kept being in my mind, is how could anyone even do it, but how could even pretend to enjoy it? Let's talk about bystanders, because bystanders were important in this, and I think that's kind of our only, not our only, but that's kind of our, what we need to do to combat it.
Absolutely, and there's a lot of really hopeful work going on in college campuses, in the military, on bystander education. And, you know, the principle is not a new one. You know, if you think about what we have done collectively around drinking and driving in the last quarter century, where, you know, if you were to roll back the clock 25 years and ask a group of people, like a group of college students, if they felt that they had a responsibility, if they were in a bar, let's say, and they noticed somebody who was clearly drunk, staggering drunk, and they reach into their pocket and take out their car keys and head for the door. You could ask a room full of students today, do you have a right or even a responsibility to try to stop that person?
Mm-hmm.
And I've done this. I've done this numerous times. You'll get literally 100% of the room will raise their hands. And in within a second, it's not, they don't even think about it. It's of course.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to do that 25 years ago, you would not have gotten anything close to that.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you'd had a small minority of people who felt like that was something that they had a responsibility to do. And so we've changed social norms pretty dramatically. Now, I think changing social norms around sexuality and sexual behavior and gender relations, this is going to be harder, much harder, you know, and it's going to take much longer. But the principle that you can educate people and you can, you know, get them, once they're educated, once they kind of see things clearly, you can inculcate in them a sense of responsibility
mm-hmm.
for other people in their community. And then you give them the tools. So good bystander education programs, you know, do this kind of step-by-step process of, you know, kind of raising consciousness, educating students or service members in the military, and then giving them the tools, you know, very specifically, concretely. What would you do if? And you practice that. So, you know, let's say, you know, because what you encounter in those kinds of programs is you say, okay, let's say you're at a fraternity party or you're at a bar or at some kind of dorm and somebody's really drunk, really intoxicated, and somebody's taking that person away, all right? What can you do, all right? Because you all recognize now that this is not okay. This is now somebody who cannot consent to whatever is going to happen here. And you know, people will articulate, they feel very, very, you know, sort of constrained. They feel, you know, I don't know what I would do. And if I were to interfere, that would be viewed by other people as, you know, as you know, other derogatory, crude derogatory terms for it. But, you know, and so you work with them and say, well, all right, if you're not willing, if you don't think you could, you know, kind of just step up there yourself, how about this? Could you turn to a friend and say, hey, would you come with me? We got to step in. Or you could maybe turn to two people, yeah. you know, and say, let's all go. Let's three of us go, because this is not right. I think we all know this, you know. So make it more of a create your own little social group, essentially. So you work with people, and you find for them individually, you know, what is the way that they can do this, that they can be an effective bystander. And the more you do this, of course, the larger the proportion of your community that you have sort of mobilized this way, the safer the community.
Mm-hmm. It strikes me that it's something that has to come from men going to men, and maybe from coaches and people at the university.
Absolutely. I do see this more and more in college campuses, where men's groups, men's organizations, sometimes fraternities, take the lead in supporting and in becoming a venue for these kinds of bystander education programs. And it's crucial that men take this kind of responsibility. It's their community too, you know, and. One of the things that I've been doing more frequently now, both in the military and on college campuses, is talking about the sexual victimization of males, primarily since we have way more research about sexual abuse of male children. I talk to them about that as a way of I find a much more effective way of drawing them in to this whole conversation. And it's a way of saying, look, this is about anybody who's vulnerable can and is targeted in this way. And you now, as an 18-year or 19-year-old male, you may not feel vulnerable. And you are less vulnerable. You're less targeted than other people, for example, than your colleagues here who are women, who are female, or they're more targeted than you are. But there are certain circumstances where you could be a target. And furthermore, when you males were children, you were just as vulnerable as other children. And we know that male children are sexually abused at phenomenal rates, you know. And that's just a way of it's a way of bringing them into this conversation in a way that I find that they are much more open then mm-hmm. to seeing this as it's a community problem, and they're welcome to be part of this community. And then let's all of us, sort of realize our responsibilities to the community.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you.
Pleasure to talk.